Welcome to the Talking Writing Podcast. I'm John Vogel, TW's creative director. Today we have writer Maris Kreitzman with us, who ran The Maris Review as a podcast interviewing writers for 4 years, and has now moved it to a weekly Substack newsletter talking about newly published books. She is also a columnist for LitHub and has freelanced widely for such publications as The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, The Atlantic, Vulture, and many others. Her book of essays, I Want to Burn This Place Down, is forthcoming from HarperCollins in July 2025. Maris's writing largely focuses on the publishing industry, social justice, and politics, but one of the areas that I was most interested in is her tendency towards pop culture. Her Tumblr blog turned published book, Slaughterhouse 90210, marries photos from television and celebrity culture with quotes from classic literature. As a 90210 obsessive myself, I was keen to geek out about the classic primetime soap opera with someone who might understand. Therefore, while the first half of our conversation focuses on the publishing world, the latter half is dedicated to 90210, Gilmore Girls, Melrose Place, and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Let's start with some background stuff, because I know you have a history as a book editor and other editor roles, and you're very, like, feel like you're very entrenched in the publishing world. Like,
yes.
You're very, very much, you know, all the Maris Review really focuses a lot on, like, different press books. So, yeah, I just wanted to ask you about, like, what's your background in publishing and your, like, sort of experience on the back end?
Yeah, I've seen it all, I feel like. When I moved to New York City in the early aughts, I was going to be a book editor. That was going to be what my career was. And I did that for about 6 years, and then I was laid off. And suddenly, my life became about trying to get near books in and around. So the next place I worked was at an MP3 company. This was the late aughts. So that had an audiobook division. So I edited their coverage there. And from there, I went on to BarnesandNoble.com, which doesn't exist anymore, really. But that was for its self-publishing platform, mostly. From there, I went to Kickstarter, where I did book outreach for them. From there, I went to Book of the Month, where I was the editorial director. And while I was doing all of this, starting in, like, 2009, I was writing the whole time. So I've written for a lot of different outlets. And I think that's really how I make my pay my bills now.
I saw you make a comment at one point about, like, art versus commerce type of discrepancy. And I know, so as a freelancer, as somebody who makes most of their money off of freelance writing, do you feel like that takes away from you being able to focus on something, like, more artistic or large that you would, like, write yourself, like a novel or a nonfiction book or something like that?
So I have a book that's going to be published next year, and that's kind of how I'm, like, even able to freelance. Like, I basically tried to write this book so I wouldn't have to get a job for a little while. and that is being edited right now. So, I would love to have more time to do my own stuff, but I would also love to, like, have one solid place where I could call home, kind of.
Yeah, I'm kind of feeling that a lot, just in terms of like getting jealous of people with 9-to-5s where it's like you clock in and you clock out and everything that you do from one end to the other is like paid for by one person.
Absolutely. And yeah, even just like dealing with people who work in book publishing, it's like, oh, you have health insurance. I forgot. Right, I also have health insurance, but through my husband.
Yeah. And I went for, I think probably 10 to 13 years or something like that with no health insurance until Obamacare. And then I got Obamacare for a little while. And now I'm on my wife's health insurance. So in the same boat.
Glad we married well.
Yes. But so the Maris Review as a podcast ended last year. One just sort of background question. What led you to stop the podcast?
So the Maris Review is a weekly podcast where I interviewed authors with new books out. And I got to do it for 4.5 years, which is pretty cool in terms of longevity, I think. And Lit Hub is who I was partnered with to put it out, asked if I wanted to write instead, basically. And I just feel like there are more eyes on the pieces I write than the interviews I do in audio, even though I love it so much. Talking to a different author every single week kept me very, very informed in a great way. It was a lot of work, but it was great.
Mm-hmm. And now that you're sort of rebooting the Maris Review as a newsletter, it's mostly like going over several different books that you've read recently that are generally new releases. Since it's mostly focused on newly published books and you're a very active reviewer, how do you balance reading for pleasure and reading for review? I know I also like kind of ran into this when I've been in reviews positions, like burning out on trying to keep up.
I am very lucky that right now I don't have an editor, which is awful, but it's also really good because I don't have someone telling me what I need to do. So I get to decide what I cover. And that is what makes it bearable, because I'm only picking up the books that interest me from the beginning anyway. And that was sort of my credo for the podcast too. Like, I only wanted to talk to authors I was already interested in talking to. And because I'm supposed to be, it wasn't criticism with that. I was like celebrating books rather than doing serious criticism.
In There Are Too Many Books or Publishing Shouldn't Be All About Quantity, which is an article you wrote for
Lit Hub.
It was Lit Hub? Okay. Yeah, I didn't note that down. I should have. But you make a good point about feeling like you have to be constantly churning stuff out to grow in a capitalistic society, and how major publishers are leaning towards AI to increase production, whereas you think they should be spending more time on each release. And you write, I'm only talking about major publishers, but small presses are vital. And if self-published books can get one day divest from Amazon, they too will be crucial in creating a healthy publishing ecosystem. What do you feel is the balance between like corporate publishing, independent publishing, and self-publishing?
Yeah. Over the past 20 years, I've watched as corporate publishing has consolidated again and again and again. There used to be a big six. And with every move that the corporate publishers take to become more corporate, there's a lot less room for less conventional voices to break out. And that's not even fair, because I feel like you could still be an undiscovered-ish author who has a book out with a major publisher. It's just that's unfortunately how books work. But indie presses have always been important. Last week I went to a party for Grey Wolf Press, mm-hmm. Which is celebrating 50 years. And at my table, someone asked me, like, why do you care so much about Grey Wolf? And I said, because they can take risks that corporate publishers can't. Like, if you follow the career of Percival Everett, he put out 25 novels with Grey Wolf that are really strange and really smart and kind of transformative. And then he made his major publisher debut recently with James, which is on the bestseller list. And that is great. And I'm glad that he has more money and more marketing budget. But those quirkier novels really just did it for me. And then in terms of self-publishing, yeah, I think Amazon has such a monopoly on the publishing space that a lot of self-published writers agree to their terms even when they're not favorable. And it would be so nice if there were a few other companies where you could reach a wide audience by self-publishing.
Yeah, I guess because I feel like it's really the reaching a large audience that's the problem. Because like right now in this era, like direct-to-consumer models are sort of easier to achieve than ever, but it's also hard to connect with the audience members, to find and connect with your audience members. I think that's like the main challenge out there.
I think that's right. And you know, I think that will always be a problem in self-publishing. I'm not sure how we solve for that, but certainly having more competition out there has to help.
And how do you feel about the in terms of not taking risks on the part of the major publishers? How do you feel like the comp system sort of plays a role in that, or maybe just expresses that, like needing to provide comparable titles when you're pitching a book, now I know how to market this because it could, you know, it's like this book and this book and this book.
John, you read my mind because I have a piece due Tuesday about this very topic.
Nice.
And the books that I love are the ones that are very hard to quantify, right? And corporate publishers love to have information. They love numbers. We all do. And if you can't get those numbers, what you can do, what they want you to do, is compare what you've written or what this book is to other books that have been successful and are a good model. And I hate seeing authors having to like contort themselves and their work to fit into the style in which publishers are willing to sell their work. I also think that that makes for a lot of bad copycat books.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be, I don't know, again, I don't know what the answer is, but I do think that letting authors be a little bit more free and able to take risks would benefit all of us.
On Tuesday, I was interviewing Jay Mumford, who had a book out called Root for the Villain that he self-published. And in the intro to the book, he talks about how when he was shopping it to different publishing agencies, they said, he's got a great story, but nobody's going to know who he is. And so that, you know, that basically everybody, nobody took his book because of that. But to me, it's like, I think the story sort of gives the perception of somebody who didn't make it, which I think is like way more common in the arts, like to find artists who like didn't quite get to the level where they could have done it for the rest of their lives, you know? And then they have to figure something else out. And that story, just like if that's the way you're looking at it, like the only thing that's going to sell this is the name of the celebrity of the author, then those stories will never get told. And I think they're important. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I agree. I don't think publishers are actively trying to not hear from the cool and interesting, less known voices. I think that it's just, there's so much information out there and there are so many people who want to tell their stories. And I hate that publishers can use what they call a platform to decide whether it's worth taking the time and the chance on a particular title. Again, I think that's why indie presses are so important too.
So one of your cornerstones is mixing together literary and pop culture. And I feel like there's an element of treating both like high and low art with equal reverence. What are your thoughts about the intersections between like the artistic and the popular?
So back when Tumblr was a thing, I had a Tumblr blog called Slaughterhouse 90210, where I would take screenshots from TV shows and pair them with quotes from literature. And I think I started out wanting to show how it's all kind of related, like they can exist in the same space. And people who watch reality television can also read the National Book Critics Circle winner for criticism, and those go together fine. And what I grew to find is that it's just so cool that when you're reading something or watching something, everything else that you've been reading and watching recently kind of informs what you think of it. And I love that feeling. And I love talking to people about what they were listening to or watching while they were kind of coming up with their writing. And so I guess, yeah, it's all interconnected, I would say.
There's a weird thing with like when people have a guilty pleasure, you know, something that they think is like they shouldn't like, but they take enjoyment out of it and therefore they feel guilt for it. And yeah, I don't know. I guess I'm just coming to like a position, a philosophical position, I guess, of like, it's all on the table. It's all like, whatever you like, you like. Just like whatever resonates with you, just go with it and enjoy it.
Absolutely. I mean, assuming that you don't have to do this for a living, like this is you trying to find entertainment and joy in something. And so do the thing that gets you that.
Right. Exactly. So yeah, let's get down to the real work talking 90210 and other pop culture. But yeah, so you've been watching you're like a full 10 seasons 90210 fan, correct?
I am, although I have to say, you know, that the high school years are just always going to be a little bit more special to me. I watch them live on television, and it just reminds me of my youth a lot, just watching that. And like, Shannon Doherty, an outstanding talent. And once we lose her, it gets a little harder.
So I didn't get into 90210 until I was in college, and they were on constant replay on the Soap Network. And I have a little bit of equal like memory for the whole thing. So I like the post, the college years and the post-college years as well. But yeah, I think most people probably see like seasons 2 through 4 as yeah. like the golden moment
yeah.
of the show.
I think that's right. And that's where like I used to have merch as a kid. Like that was when I was really intense about it.
Mm-hmm.
I had a shirt. It was white, and it said 90210 in like a fluorescent orange. But the one was Luke Perry.
Very nice. And so speaking of Luke Perry and Dylan McKay, so Jess Mariano from Gilmore Girls is sort of like, and Gilmore Girls I was introduced to by my wife, who was a big fan, so we've watched the whole thing, and she was always like a Jess Mariano, like, proselytizer, like, that was her dude. So, yeah, and there are lots of comparisons with the James Dean literary sort of figure in both Jess Mariano and Dylan McKay. So, yeah, could you compare and contrast the two characters and also your feelings towards them?
Yeah, I mean, again, Dylan hit it at just the right time. Like, I was a tween. I was feelings. There's also, though, something about, like, I think I have more complicated feelings about Jess because I also watched the Gilmore Girls in, like, one foul swoop. Mm-hmm. And they constantly just gave Rory not great love interests overall. So, like, there's not much good to compare to, even. And I saw that even in the reboot.
Mm-hmm.
They give Rory a lot less to work with, let's say. Mm-hmm. And there's also that kind of the lore, the legend around Luke Perry at this point is that he was just like the nicest guy.
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to be quote unquote dangerous as a character and also be a nice dude, it's just perfect.
Who do you feel like has better literary taste and literary arguments?
Gosh, it's been a little while since I watched Gilmore Girls. And really what I remember most about Gilmore Girls is Rory's books, is the books that she would carry around. I'm trying to remember exactly what Jess was even into. Like, Dylan was so clearly into romantic poetry and like beat stuff, which to me was the coolest thing you could be into in the 90s, you know, the beats.
Right. And Bukowski, he was.
And Bukowski.
Yeah. Which is kind of like a obvious choice, I guess. The only thing I remember specifically about Jess was that he, I think he was like, I think if Jane Austen was around right now, she'd be into Charles Bukowski. But that's the only one, the clear one that I remember. I just remember there being like peppered, like here and there, like literary references where he would talk about them.
Yeah, I mean, the show itself was very literary, of course. Like, I mean, just the idea that Norman Mailer made a guest appearance on that show is so funny to me and so bizarre, and it's one of my favorite things about him.
So Melrose Place, were you into Melrose? You weren't into Melrose Place first, because if you're watching 90210 live, they didn't come in till the third season.
So I watched the spinoff when everyone started. And then for a while, the two were on the same night, and that mm-hmm. was Thursday night. And that's what you did. And it's fun.
But yeah, you talk about the scene where Kimberly rips her hair off as being one of the undeniable greatest scene in television history.
Yeah.
And I was like, what about Dylan waking up in his car, smoking heroin and seeing a cop car and then driving directly off a cliff and into an abyss, which stands out as, like, to me, one of my favorite scenes of television history. Does that scene hold as much power for you as it does for me?
I think the thing with Kimberly was we just really weren't expecting it. Where when she's ripping off her wig, it felt like there was a moment when, like, you don't know what she's going to turn into. Like, you don't know what she's doing here. She could be an alien. Like, we don't know. And with Dylan, it might be that just we wanted better for the character. But also, like, I feel like they constantly had him going through stuff. And it took a little bit of the surprise out of that particular moment.
I think for me, the surprise of the moment was just like it's just going so far. Like the sequence of events, of like, I guess, downward spiral.
Yeah.
Like literal downward spiral.
I mean, I do think that's the Melrose Place influence too. Like,
right.
Just getting more and more melodramatic as each season goes on.
Now on to Brandon a little bit. Like, so he's obviously, like, throughout the course of the whole thing, of the whole series, he sort of he's into journalism at first, and then he joins into the political realm when he tries to run for office in high school. And then he goes back to journalism at the beginning of college, and then he goes back to politics in the middle of college, and then he goes back to journalism. Yeah, how do you feel about his journalistic drive and his political drive and the way that those two, the tension between those?
It's so interesting because you can, like, kind of, I can imagine the writing meetings being like, no, he cares about the issues, but no, he just wants to make speeches or like whatever it is. And looking back, it's like Brandon was a politician from the get-go. Like it's so clear in retrospect. Whereas I think the journalism just was a device so that we could have Andrea Zuckerman in our lives.
Right. Who do you think was a better journalist, Andrea Zuckerman or Brandon?
I mean, I have to give it to Andrea. I don't know.
I agree.
But, like, she seems a lot more focused.
Well, and the ethical dilemmas, because Brandon has several instances where he sort of, like, brushes his ethics aside, especially for Steve, in several different scenes. But he doesn't do the same thing when it comes to, for example, Claire, when her dad is meeting with the
Prime dictator.
Minister of... Yeah. And he goes full expose on her, even though it will cost him their friendship. How do you feel about his ethical breaches in those realms?
That's what makes him more of a politician. I think that he wants to be as principled as his friend Andrea, but there is still that desire from Brandon to fit in, to be liked, to be accepted, and I think that indicates that he's more of a politician.
Right. So, yeah, have you rewatched Melrose Place and 90210, like, in more recent years? Is this...
So, I rewatched the first two seasons of 90210, like, during, like, lockdown.
Mm-hmm.
For just a little bit of comfort and joy. And Melrose Place a little bit before that, like 2017 or 2018 or so. But I've watched both at different stages of my life, for sure.
Well, I would like to ask, like, a more general re-watching and re-reading question, because I'm an avid re-watcher and re-reader. Like, I will re-read and re-watch stuff, like, to an obsessive degree. Do you have that impulse too, or do you feel like you prefer to keep moving?
Especially with TV, I love a rewatch. Maybe with books, there are ones I go back to for sure. but my pile is so big. there definitely is more of an impetus to keep on moving. And where TV is just like truly the most comfortable thing I can do is watch a rerun of one of my favorite shows.
I tried to rewatch Melrose Place during a repeat of 90210, and I just felt like it didn't have the, it didn't age as, I wouldn't say as well, it didn't age as entertainingly as 90210. What were your thoughts when going back through them?
Both of those shows aired at a time when there was a thriving daytime soap opera industry, and these would be kind of called nighttime soaps. And you could just see Melrose, especially, like, just trying to outdo itself with bizarre stuff. And I think that was really fun to watch the first time. And I think it kind of loses the plot somewhere in season five. And yeah, again, it's nothing will give me that kind of nostalgia like 90210.
Nice. The last question I have written down is when you're watching 90210 and Buffy, the Vampire Slayer, do you ever make up a relationship between West Beverly High and Sunnydale High, both of them having been filmed at the same high school, Torrance High School in California?
Isn't that wild? Like, you can imagine that Kelly and Donna one time stumbled upon the Hellmouth, you know? And like, I see a lot of crossover potential there, for sure.
Yeah, like, I've thought about it, like, what if they presented it like 90210 was sort of like the upside down of Sunnydale, you know? Mm. And they were just like on top of each other, but like one was, and who's to say which one is the bottom of the upside down and which one's the like upper level, you know?
I love this idea. I wonder if I feel like that's a Tumblr blog.
But yeah, that's pretty much all I have. What are you reading right now? What are you excited about? I saw you reviewed the new Miranda July book, which I'm excited to read because I really loved The Last Bad Man. Mm-hmm. When I read it.
I really enjoyed that novel. And I read it, but then I also listened to her read it on the audiobook. And if you have the chance, that is for sure the way to go. Like, she makes, you know, because she's an actress too, she makes it feel really vital. A book I just read that I really enjoyed was Victim by Andrew Barriga. I think I called it The Fabulous by Stephen Elliott meets Erasure by Percival Everett. It's a really smart debut novel about the kinds of stories that we as in the media and also we as just people want to hear from people of color. And it was really smart and fun.
Nice. So yeah, that's everything that I have written down. Is there anything that you would like to add, or anything that you would, any topics that you would like to discuss?
I thank you for shouting out my podcast, and now my Substack. I forget what I have at this point. But yeah, I am really enjoying doing the Substack, and I hope it's entertaining and helpful, practical, if you like books. So that's mariskreisman.substack.com.
But yeah, that's all I've got. So thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you, John.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for listening to the Talking Writing Podcast. We're an independent literary site and nonprofit organization based in the Boston area, but with contributors from around the world. Since our founding in 2010, we've relied on donations to keep publishing and podcasting. To donate to TW, you can use the donate button on the rss.com page of this podcast or visit talkingwriting.com/donate. And of course, feel free to drop us a line at editor@talkingwriting.com.